Oh yeah, we're coming up on Christmas with another Jim Brown Outrage Capercast. I sure hope you all have a good time with your friends and families over this next big deal weekend. Last time we started in on a series called The Next Last Chapter. It's an update to my book, Among the Multihulls, sort of try to gather in all of what's happened since the book was published. And I wrote that 25 pages in a text document that's also posted on Outrage Media. But I'm told that most of you folks would rather listen than read. So this is number 2 in a series of what could become 20 oral updates to the text updates to Among the Multihulls, chapter by chapter. And so, just like last time, we'll start by asking Christy to read to us the abstract or a brief synopsis of Chapter 2 of Among the Multihulls. And boy, has she ever been nice lately. She even looks juicy. Gee, Christy, don't you look great?
Why, thank you, Jimsy boy, but quit your visual groping, you lech. And let me read this abstract for Chapter 2 in your book Among the Multihulls. The chapter title is Promise Made, and it starts in your schooner bumming days. Now it seems to me you've never progressed from that wild oats time. At 84 you still think you're a lascivious hunk. But anyway, the abstract reads like this. The author meets his most formative mentor, an early multihull pioneer. Together they voyage from Miami to Columbia in 1956 with a very game young woman in their crew. This mentor and woman disappear from the story for the next 30 years, but the author resolves to pursue a nautical life on his own. Obsessively keeping this youthful resolution is the theme of the next 9 chapters. Wow, that's obsessive, Jimmy. Let's hear about that promise.
Well, all right, but I didn't make that promise. That promise made me. Before I got into schoonering, I was, you know, lost as a dog in the fog. I had either flunked out or walked out of 3 colleges. Yes, I had somehow managed to preserve my student exemption from the draft, otherwise I probably would have been picked off in Korea. The Korean War, Jesus, will we ever learn? You know, where have all the flowers gone? You know, when will they ever learn? But, of course, before long we jumped into another land war in Asia. And another, well, maybe early intervention is the only watchdog technique available. But anyway, I proved unwilling to invest my life in that adventure. But I ended up in school down in Miami, you know, trying to study something about Latin American relations. And I think I've told you about how I joined a little skin diving club at the college. I had done a little diving in the Keys by then. But the story goes that one of the guys in the club had a sister who was the girlfriend of one Mike Burke, who started that Windjammer Barefoot Cruises outfit. And through his sister, we managed to get a decent rate on the boat for a weekend of diving in Bimini. And I enjoyed the diving and the camaraderie, but what really got me was the schooner. A really beautiful 80-foot Carvel-built all inside schooner, no bowsprit, no boomkin, easy to sail. Her name was Tondaleo. That comes from literature. I can't remember where. Tondaleo. Well, we got back from Bimini late Monday night, and Tuesday morning I was back down there on the dock saying to the captain, Mike Burke, hey, I want to work for you. You don't have to pay me. You just have to keep me alive. I want to work in this boat. And that was it, man. My life took a left turn that never looked back. It's been one damn boat after another ever since. But Mike Burke and I made a pretty good team, and pretty soon he mortgaged everything he had in order to buy a much bigger boat, the 151-foot steel staysail schooner then named Janine, a combination of Jeanette and Doreen, the daughters of the British royalty representative in the Bahamas, Sir Oliver Simmons. Well, Sir Oliver's crew was bringing the boat back up from the Caribbean into the southern Bahamas and stacked it up on Great Inagua Island. I was told the skipper was drunk. Now, the boat was deal, so it lay on its side for a few days on the reef in the surf, right on the edge of that tremendous trench that runs between the Bahamas and Cuba. They call it the Old Bahama Channel. It's a big, beautiful piece of ocean, but treacherous on all sides. So Sir Oliver got a seagoing tug to come from, I think, from New Orleans and drag that thing off the reef. She was steel, you know. Her bilge on the port side was a bit oil canned, but otherwise the boat was essentially undamaged except for water damage. It had filled half full of water and lay there for days, you know. The tug brought the boat back to Nassau, Bahamas, and that's where Burke and I went to see it. And, hey, man, we figured, hey, we can fix this. And it was so beautiful. It was really like right out of the movies. Just a tremendous stature of this boat. It was just an amazing thing. A very modern yacht built by Fife in Scotland, I believe. Steel hull, teak deck over. Steel masts, the main mast was 176 feet up. And with the help of all of the black Bahamians in the crew, the boat still had a crew aboard of Bahamians. They had done most of the work of cleaning her up after seawater immersion. Of course, her batteries were toast. A huge battery bank down in the bills. They were all toast, but we had to leave them in there because the weight, where their weight was needed in order to make the boat sail properly. A big old Gardiner diesel engine with a little blowtorch on each cylinder head. You had to start up 6 blowtorches in order to get the engine to start. Preheat the cylinder heads. And rigging, oh my land, it was really something to try to learn to drive that ship. But with the help of the Bahamian bosun, Mr. Fred McKenzie, I began to learn the ways of a windjammer. And I've told you about all that before, but one trip we were loading up in Miami. We were boarding passengers and beer in Miami. I had the beer concession on board. That was really my only source of income. So the beer truck was there, and we were sliding 50 cases of stuff off into the ship. We were tied up there right opposite the MacArthur Causeway, Miami. And I saw coming across the water this really strange contraption. It was about 32 feet long. It had 2 hulls, and they were all hooked together by a spider web of old pipes welded. And the deck between these 2 hulls was comprised of wooden slats. And on the wooden slats, there was a great big box which served as a cockpit. Looked like an old shipping crate. So this thing came across the water and tied up along the bulkhead right in front of us. And this guy came out of it, long, skinny geek with long, blonde hair, bleached yellow. Came over to me and asked to speak with the captain. Well, I thought, here we go. Turned out he had been invited to come aboard. The captain needed pictures for a brochure. And this guy, he was German. He had a bunch of fancy camera equipment. And Mike Burke asked him to come along on a trip and take some pictures. He needed a color brochure. So we took off with probably 20 people aboard. A skin diving club from Peoria or some such, men and women. And pretty soon I found this German guy was kind of following in my footsteps. He was trying to help with anything I was doing. And that was okay with me, especially when it came to hoisting that mainsail. Man, we had to get as many passengers who would pull all lined up on the halyard line way down the deck, you know, hauling away to get this huge mainsail up the mast. We'd get it up as tight as we could with a double reeve halyard on one side. And then we'd turn to the other end of the halyard on the other side, on the other shrouds. It had a 16-part purchase, and we were able to climb up on that thing and start hauling on it to peak the mainsail up, get it up tight enough with the halyard. No downhaul. And little by little, I got to know this guy, and it turned out that he really knew more about sailing than I did, but he didn't know anything about the boat. Turned out the only boat he'd ever sailed in his life was that catamaran contraption. But he made more trips with us than he was invited because he and I really did need help in shepherding the divers. You know, you get 10 or 15 people in the water, some of them with lungs, and man, somebody has to keep an eye out on all of them. And so Wolfie and I became the dive masters and the sailing masters. Officially, I was called the mate, but I was totally unqualified to be mate of the boat, and it was only with the help of Fred McKenzie, the bosun, that we managed to drive that ship the first several trips. You know, we finally learned the ropes. So on one of those trips, there was a young woman passenger. She had, we learned later, she had just been through a divorce, and she was off to, you know, find a little independence, and she and Wolfie really hit it off. Her name was Jeannie. Of course, the big German guy's name was Wolfie, or Wolfgang, Krocker von Schwarzenfeld. And Wolfgang became probably the most important mentor in my young life, most formative in how I got this way. After one thing and another, we both ended up in the crew of another yacht, much smaller, a 51-foot steel catch on its way to South America. It had just been bought by a Colombian citizen, but a German emigree to Colombia. His name was Hans Hoffmann. He was a good enough guy to take the three of us off to South America in his new catch named La Brisa. Yes, Jeannie was with us. Our first stop was in Havana, and we had, of course, been operating one of Burke's big schooners out of Havana for a while, so we knew the town, Wolfie and I. In fact, I had a girlfriend there, and I called her and asked her if she'd like to come down to the boat this evening, and she said, "No, I can't come tonight." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Because we're having a revolution tonight." Well, this was all happening in about 1956, and, you know, Batista didn't get run out of Cuba until 59. But there was still a lot of clandestine pushing and shoving going on, and as a matter of fact, the army was at war with the navy. Yeah, the Cuban army base was on the far eastern side of the harbor there at Havana, beautiful pocket bay harbor, long, narrow entrance. And the navy's headquarters was on the city side, the west side of the harbor. we were there one night, that night that my friend Josefa could not come to the ship. In the middle of the night, there was all kinds of calamity going on outside. I stuck my head out and noticed tracer bullets flying right over our masthead. The army was shooting at the navy. The navy headquarters was on the civil the real city side of the harbor, and there were fires and you know sirens and bombs going off. And holy moly, we pulled up the anchor and got out of there. And it was many a year before I got back to Havana. But that was my first direct experience with having the mobility to simply, you know, split this pop stand, bug out from a geopolitical hotspot. And I didn't realize then how important that experience would become to me later. But anyway, we sailed La Brisa down around the western end of Cuba and off into the Southwest Caribbean, where you have to get out there to the east of that great hump of Honduras that sticks out, has that cape on there called Cape Thank God. And we have to get out wide around that and pass between a couple of reefs in order to work your way on down toward Panama and Colombia. And this was long before GPS, of course, and Wolfie was doing a celestial navigation. But the sky was not clear enough to really get a good shot on anything. So we were kind of feeling our way southward down there between those two reefs. There's a big one on the east side. It's called Quitasueño, Nights of Little Sleep. And on the other side, I've told you this story. On the other side, there's another one called Abre Ojos, Keep Your Eyes Open. And, of course, it happened that we were making the passage at night, and it was dangerous. We were doing our best to look around. Hadn't had much sleep. Wolfie had been up all night. It was his turn to get some rest. Not light yet, about 4 in the morning. So the owner and I came up to take the helm, and I was out on the bow, you know, looking for surf and trying to see the bottom. And as soon as the false dawn appeared, the owner called me back to the cockpit, and he said, "Hey, listen, Jim, do you think you can climb the rigging in these conditions?" We were really stomping along, you know. But we did have ratlins, you know, that rigging ladder on one side of the mast only. It turned out that that was the starboard side, and it was the lee side, and the boat was heeled way over. But I told him, yeah, sure, I can get up there. So I started climbing the ratlins, first of all, on the inboard side of the ratlins. And then when I got up close to the first spreader, I had to cross around to the outboard side of the ratlins and really hook myself into the shrouds and the first spreader, the cross tree up there. I was supposed to hang on for a while and wait for more light and try to spot this island we were headed for, a place called Old Providence Island. And it took a while before I was able to spot the place, and in the meantime I had myself the most unforgettable ride up there. Looking down on the ketch, it looked like a model of itself, and the owner, sitting in the cockpit there on the helm, sort of looked like some kind of a toy puppet. And looking down into the water from that low light, the water looked absolutely black. That is, the ship and its wake, its white wake streaming out astern, looked like they were all just mounted on black velvet with black lighting. The boat was soaring through space. One reason the wake was so bright white was that it was all lit up with phosphorescence, those little dinoflagellates in the water. When agitated, they go off like lightning bugs, and so the wake was all agitated and just foaming, glowing white. And then I noticed the deep wake of the boat. This boat drew about 7 feet of water, and coming out from behind its keel was underwater phosphorescence. It had been agitated by the passing of the keel, and it created what you might describe as a contrail, a subsurface contrail caused by the boat, but I could see the wake streaming out astern down deep where all of the phosphorescence was filtered by the water itself so that it came up through the surfaces, sort of that beautiful blue-green. Man, it was really beautiful. But the ride was pretty rough in pitch. When the vessel would climb up over a wave, of course, the mast and sails were heaved aft, sort of against and into the wind, and the sails would scoop up great gulps of wind, which, after all, was our fuel. To translate it all into forward thrust, even though the masts and sails were heaving back. And then the vessel would drop down over a crest, and the mast and sails would heave forward, and they would all flutter up there a little bit. I was up high enough so that the sound of the wind and the sails actually echoed off of the water and made this wonderful wooing, scooping, you know, scoop, spill, scoop, spill sound up there. It was sinusoidal, you know. The power was coming in spurts, but they were, you know, 5 to 7 seconds apart. It was nothing like the kind of power we hear from an internal combustion engine. That's really a flow of detonations. Incidentally, the first name for the internal combustion engine was the internal explosion engine. Every stroke of that piston is caused by an explosion, which for all such engines, of course, means that you have to burn stuff in order to get the power. The way things are going these days, boy, we are burning lots of stuff. So anyway, gradually the light came up, and I could see out across the horizon. There were wisps of cloud out there. Some of it was very high, just turning pink with the day coming up in the east, and some of it was down low as fog, and it was still purple and blue. And there I was, you know, halfway up the mast in a bathing suit, hanging on for dear life, really enjoying the view. And we thought the island was somewhere ahead to starboard, but I couldn't spot it. I was doing my best to peer out around the jib. And finally, taking a great risk, I climbed around to the upwind side of the mast and looked out to port forward, and there was this something hard sticking up through the fog. It just had to be the very top of Old Providence Island. And spotting that thing under those circumstances was probably one of the most powerful visual experiences I've ever enjoyed. The sight of my first tropical island emerging in the dawn. You know, it was rich. Well, we found our way in there and anchored and hung around for a few days. There was a lot going on. We had a lot to do to the boat, and we had to get to know the islanders a bit. Communication was very spotty, by shortwave radio only. But it turned out that this guy Hoffman, the owner of the boat, had to go back to Columbia for business reasons. He was the Cessna aircraft distributor for Columbia. And I don't know, maybe he had a big sale or something, but he hired a DC-3. Yeah, there was a little airstrip on the island. DC-3 came up, picked him up, took him back to Columbia, and he left us there for, I don't know, must have been a month. On this beautiful island, in this beautiful boat, with just the three of us, we had a lot to do, but working on the boat, you know, that's all detailed in the chapter, you know, if you want to read the book. But anyway, one night we were sitting around in the cabin, just gabbing, got into the subject of freedom, how just wonderfully free we were by having this yacht to float around in, going new places, meeting new people. We were feeling quite satisfied with ourselves until Jeannie brought up the point that the only trouble with our current existence is that the boat belonged to someone else. You know, here we were in this idyllic situation, and yet we were, in a way, we were hamstrung. We had come to go traveling and adventuring, and it all depended, of course, on the whims of the owner of the yacht. So we began talking of the possibility of maybe getting our own boat. Wolf was playing with his sketch pad. He was always drawing something. He turned up the lamp, and he was furiously darting at his page with his pencil, and he said something like, "The only trouble with my boat was she needs another boat in between." And of course, I started laughing, and he said, he was getting pretty good with English. He said, "What you laughing at for?" And I said, "What you drawing at for?" He turned the sketch pad around to show it to me, and he said with, you know, long, very guttural R's, he said, "Trimaran." Of course, that was the first time I had heard the word. It had been coined some 10 years earlier on Long Island, New York, by the crazy Russian artist Victor Chechet, who began building small trimarans in the 1940s. But I'd never heard of him, and neither had Wolf. So there are several phases in multi-hull development that could be called a classic case of reinvention, or concurrent simultaneous inventions in different places by different people, unknown to one another. Well, we talked about a lot of things that night, including Wolf's origin, how it was that he started out from Holland in a tin catamaran, having never before in his life ever even seen the sea. And yet he had crossed the ocean to America, where we met him. That stuff all appears in the text chapter. But anyway, the three of us were really getting stoked up about having our own boat. The whole notion was drummed up and sketched out in a fit of great excitement down in that cabin anchored at that island. But suddenly we heard this sound. It was music coming from somewhere, and I stuck my head up and looked around, bumped my head on the damn boom horse, which was right over the main hatch, man. You could always clobber your head on that thing. And I could hear music sort of echoing from all around the harbor. I didn't know where it was coming from, but looking out at the moon was just rising. Well, it was well up, let's say, you know, up 10 degrees above the horizon, and it was throwing a very bright avenue of moonlight reflections on the sea. You know how that avenue starts right underneath the moon and glitters on the water and gets wider and wider and wider as it comes at you. I could see the swells mounting up on the reef out there, and as they broke, they'd send a bunch of spume up off of the top of the breaker, and all of that was backlighted in the moonlight. It didn't make a colorful thing like a rainbow, but it definitely made a brilliant white circular or arc-shaped halo over the top of the waves. And all of a sudden, sailing out onto this glittering avenue came this little boat. It was not too far away from us. We could see there were several people in it. The moonlight was shining right through the sail, and you could see that the sail was made out of a bunch of rags, you know, stitched together out of anything, as emphasized by the backlight of the moon. And we could hear a guitar and maybe a drum. There were hands clapping, people singing. And I noticed there was a straight glint, a reflection off of the side of a bottle being raised, you know, which was all appearing in silhouette against this bright moon avenue. This little native smack silhouetted against this absolute sea of popping flash bulbs. Jeannie and Wolf came up. I think Wolf bumped his head on the boom horse, too. And when Jeannie heard the music, she said, "Let's invite them over." So Wolf reached down to the hatch where he could reach the running light switches. And he flashed the running lights and the spreader lights on the boat. And here they came. I thought, oh, boy, we're going to have to offer these folks something to eat or drink. And they came over. I went down below to get our bottle of rum. Couldn't find it at first. It was still half full. As I went back on deck, these people were boarding from their little smack. It was some of the islanders. We had met maybe a couple of them before. The music continued as they boarded, you know. It was really just a wonderful swinging sight. So we enjoyed with them what they called a moon sing. Hey, there's a possible boat name for you, or for me anyway, moon sing. And, oh, well, this could go on forever. You know, it's all detailed in the chapter, but by the time that night was over, man, I was really committed to the cruising lifestyle. The whole thing just came together for me there. I thought, this is way too much fun not to be doing it. I think maybe I could get a boat of my own, even if the three of us didn't stick together to do it together, which seemed unlikely later on that night. But Wolf and Jeannie and I continued to sail together for months, lived aboard the boat there in Cartagena, Colombia. Had some real adventures I've told you about in other podcasts. And the upshot was that I came away from that whole cruise feeling that I simply must involve boats and the sea in the rest of my life. And as life goes along with people fading in and out of your existence from time to time, I lost track of Wolf and Jeannie for the next 30 years. And finally was visited by Wolf. He came to America to see me at our place here in Virginia. We went for a nice ride in Scrimshaw. He, too, had lost track of Jeannie. In fact, I'll be surprised if we ever get a hold of her again, but the end of the story here is that I have again, just this week, recontacted Wolfgang Crocker von Schwarzenfeld. Ta-da! I've had a couple of friends, scouring the internet for him. Sure as heck, he's turned up to be quite a well-known sculptor in Germany. Was responsible for a big sculpture garden somewhere in a park in, I think, Munich, called Global Stone. And it looks like Wolfie used his 75-foot staysail schooner to sail around the world and pick up interesting glyphs, you know, chunks of rock that have human markings on them, and bring them back to Germany and put them up in a sculpture garden and get in trouble with some of the places where he brought them from, where he was told that he had complete permission and blah, blah, had to give some back or something. All of that appears on his website called Global Stone. But I finally have a direct email address for him and have written to him just the day before yesterday. And so this is breaking news, folks. I'll let you know what happens. I've sort of invited myself to go and see him this time. Whoa, I must insert a real mention of thanks here. Some of you listeners have really pitched in significant contributions. Almost all of you, $50 or more, sometimes twice as much. Joe and I are really grateful to you folks for helping us put this show on the road. Here are a few names. Jeffrey Lyford. Then there's the guy who just goes by Wilford. And Wade Tarzia. Thank you, old friend. Roger Green. Simon Kinnear. Rich Hadke. Dennis Clapp. And Anthony Basso. Tony Basso, you've been on this list before. Thank you so much, you guys. You've been great. And you gents who donate small amounts per month by using Patreon, you know, by the time we get this this video tractor published, you will be up in the significant donor range, too. And so, hey, I think all your names belong on the credits list. We got to do something about acknowledging our supporters. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. I must figure out some kind of gift for all of you for what you've given to us. I hope you all have a really good time over the holidays. And a good year coming, okay? Fair winds to you all. Bye-bye.